Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Thank you all for spending time with us this weekend, and boy, oh boy, we had a busy week. A lot of company updates, a lot of market updates for a week that was kind of boring for the markets, but boring in a good way because everything continues to, or not everything, close to everything, continues to, in a way, melt up. Markets, the broad averages are doing well. Crypto's doing well. Commodities continue to do well. Really seems like the U.S. dollar, that's been weak, and bonds, that's been boring. Other than that, I assume a lot of people are out there watching their portfolio, again, kind of melt higher. We'll cover that, all these different markets in the first half of the show, and in the back half of the show, going to focus a little more on the old school energy, oil and natural gas, two other markets that have been slow, kind of boring, but again, a lot of other opportunities out there. So without further ado, we're kicking off this show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail individual side, probably the side that most of you, our listeners, care about, check out the In The Know Trader website. I'll post a link in the show notes. Rick has two products, a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report and a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. Rick, let's just start off. Big picture comments. It seems like there are a lot of bull markets out there. Arguably, a lot of bubbles out there forming as well. What's your takeaway from this environment where markets continue to melt up and it's not just one or two sectors that seem to be leading this melt up?
Well, sure, when we look at weighted stock indexes, they're on all-time highs. So you have SPYs and Qs, which obviously are the S&P 500 and NASDAQ 100 at all-time highs. And generally, over the last couple of weeks, every week, they're making new all-time highs. A couple of the 5 days are pushing to them each week, sometimes even more than that. So when we look from that perspective, the market's doing just fine. But if I were to ask you, let's say in the last 8 weeks, how many of the 11 sectors are actually performing and even doing better than the S&P, there's actually only two of them, two of 11, technology and industrials. And the other nine are underperforming. So it's a very weighty, top-heavy kind of rally. Many did not see that coming off of the April low. And in one of the rare circumstances where the investing public outsmarted the institutional world, they were big buyers on the way up, whereas institutions were mostly selling into the rally. And many of them have missed the last, fair to say, probably 50% of the rally off of that April low. So you get a sense of not only where the public's interested, because it's been mostly large cap tech, mega cap tech, that's pushed this higher. And then the industrial sector, which almost for always is essentially kind of a neutral weight type of sector because it is so diversified. Most of them kind of wash themselves out over the course of the year, and you really don't get much alpha out of industrials. This year, you really are getting some. And part of it is, here, I'll give you two examples of kind of sectors at the extreme. On the top end is something like aerospace and defense. A lot of people use ETFs to track that. One of the ones I look at frequently is XAR ticker. And that's been flying and historically way above its 50-week moving average to the point that it's deeply overbought here. So I can recommend that now's the time and place that you first come into that. And then you've had something like, you know, let's call it home builders, which only until recently has gotten a bounce and was kind of on the worst side of that. And that's why industrials often end up just being kind of a sector that most PMs are generally in the equal weight neighborhood because they're really tough to materially underperform or materially outperform. This year is one of those rare times that that's happening. But it's only those two sectors, XLK tech and XLI industrials, that show continued kind of trendiness of outperformance with positive momentum. Everything else looks quite poor. What I did tell my institutional clients and actually retail clients also, now they think about it, in the last 2 weeks is that I think the trough, the bottom, has been put in into healthcare in the sense of its massive underperformance and the trend of just how much downside momentum there's been. So I can't tell you that it's just going to start outperforming, but I think that some really beaten down healthcare sector names are probably worth looking at simply to get a sense of things that are really deeply oversold. And if you look at the 11 sectors, XLV healthcare is by far the absolute worst over the last several months and is finally just, picking up a little bit to be less bad. But it at least gives me a sense of potentially looking at some names in that space.
Okay, so maybe a opportunity in the healthcare space at some select names that coming off the bottom, maybe getting a little bit of a boost. And to the point you made about institution versus retail investors and how one of the few times where you've seen retail buy the dip and get it right in the weighted averages or in the big tech and institutions from running for the hills a couple months ago. We've been talking about this a lot on the show recently, Rick, that there does seem to be a slightly more informed retail investor base than maybe what you would have seen a decade ago because of the ease of information sharing. But there's also a little bit of frothiness under the surface in certain pockets. Like we've seen a return of the meme stocks in the last couple of weeks where a number of names of kind of beat up companies got a boost on the gamma options plays. And you saw it in Krispy Kreme and you saw it in American Eagle Outfitters. You saw it in Kohl's department. So some isolated names, but there's also things like Reddit having a big bounce, or when you look at Coinbase and the people in the crypto space, scorching higher. Look at Robinhood stock. We've mentioned that a couple of times, blasting to all-time highs. Is there just a preference for people to be in those high-risk, high-return plays over the safer names right now, over value stocks? And is that why we're seeing these weird pockets of concentration blasting higher where other spiders maybe not doing so well?
If you're a retail investor, the answer is probably no. If you're a retail trader, then the answer is to look selectively and find some of the stuff that's beaten down. And then I don't listen or watch or subscribe to or get any of these, what do you call them? Like, what's the word I'm thinking of? It's something board, BOARD, like these websites where they post to. And meme stocks get a whole list of followers, whether it's through Reddit or some of these other places. If you're a trader, sure, you can look at, most shorted stocks and then look to see, how, when, or why there may be a reason that there could be a short squeeze. And if you want to play that, fine. Look at something like Kohl's earlier this week that was up huge, and the last couple of days it got destroyed. That's for traders, and you have to be good at technicals and you have to have discipline, but that's not for most people. That's, for traders who think they can outsmart others. The reality is very few get to be able to do that successfully over time. For your basic retail investor who's buy and hold, you kind of want to look more at quality names, and it could be quality names in beaten down sectors, but that's kind of where I think you generally want to put your time and effort into, and not be looking to, buy a stock that's heavily shorted and for the luck of maybe you'll catch a 10 to 20% move quickly. That's not for most people.
Rick, for I guess even the longer term investor, what about looking internationally? Because as well as, yes, the broad averages have done, I guess led by a few, only a couple of sectors, international markets have actually performed even better than US markets. Are we continuing to see this shift in capital flows?
Okay, so let me say something to what you just said. And that is that from basically the first of the year until the April low in the stock market, when the market was down, international did better. But since April 7th, the SPYs have done far better than international. So it's given back at least, I don't know, it's probably something in the neighborhoods of 40% of what international beat early on in the year is gone. Now, do I think you need to have non-US exposure? Yes. And I have personally, I have Fez, the ticker FEZ, which is kind of like the Dow Jones of Europe. That's the Euro Stoxx 50, the best 50 names in Europe. I own ACWX, which is the MSCI All World Country Index X, or non, not including the US. So I do have international exposure, but the conversation about non-US doing much better than US this year is really from the beginning of the year into April. And now maybe where you're getting closer to a potential bounce point for Europe to start doing better. But I'm not convinced that for the long term, if you look out the next 5 years or 10 years, that you're going to do better outside of the US. It's pretty darn rare that over time the US underperforms. Oh yeah, there are pockets of time, but you can't beat US innovation, you can't beat US expenditures on that innovation. So I think you still, most investors should be US dominant, but you should definitely have, I'd say, at least 10% of all your equity exposure in non-US. Where else do I have? I own EWJ, that's Japan. That got a nice boost this week because of the tariff deal. And that's actually something I recommended, I don't know, a month ago or something like that to my weekly tactical trader report clients was we bought EWJ. And it's doing very nicely. Better than right now, better than the S&P.
Well, Rick, another sector that's been pretty hot is the metal space. Not so much oil and gas and the commodities, but when you look at gold, it's holding up there, but the gold stocks have done some catch up and even seen some things filtering down into the smaller junior stocks. But silver with a big catch up trade, the highest level it's been since 2011, and up to $39 now an ounce. And you've seen copper this week at an all-time high again, some of that on the back of the Trump noise around putting tariffs on copper, but copper had already popped its head above $5 twice. These are the highest levels copper's ever been. Platinum at the highest level it's been in 14 years. Palladium catching fire again. So really across the board in a lot of the metals, a lot of action, but in the related equities, a lot of life there too. Are you following at all some of these moves in the commodity space?
I certainly am. I got my start in the commodities industry, and part of what I write about every week for both retail and institution, I cover the commodity sector. I tend to focus on the metals and energy parts, and I'm not generally looking at the cattle and coffee markets, but I look at the most deep liquid ones, and that tends to be oil, natural gas, and across the metal space. So I am a big fan of metals. Gold topped in April. It's consolidating. This, if you were pull up a chart of COMEX futures for gold, you have a perfect downtrend line from that April high that you draw to the June high, and then this week's high was right against that same downtrend. So kind of in a descending. You can actually, depending upon how you draw it, you actually have kind of a pennant formation, so a triangular formation. And I'm hoping to get kind of a washout towards the downside, not a huge one, but just something that gets us back towards something in the neighborhoods of under 3,200 to 3,100 in gold to reload on the upside. I still think over time it's heading higher. Silver right here, actually, I just sent one of the largest portfolio managers in the world who runs a metals fund a chart on silver, which like kind of right here, right now, I wouldn't be buying silver. It's up against some targets and the four unrelated targets are all in this general area that SLV is trading right now. So I'm not going to buy it right here, right now, but I've been long. I got into silver a little too early after in 2011 when it got up to, I think it was, I don't remember if it was a $40 high. back then, I bought SLV and I think it was like $22 or $24 range. And I've held it now, obviously, it's 14 years. Has not been a good long-term investment versus some other things. But finally, silver is, picked up nicely. I'm making decent money on it now. And I'm not really looking to sell it, but you could make the case to take some profits in it now, as long as you're willing to give up some upside in order to replace it lower, or just wait for a pullback in order to buy some more down. But I do think metals have still decent room to go on the upside. I don't know if silver can take out the $50 high that it saw in 1980 when the Hunt brothers tried to corner the silver market, but I still in general like silver, but right here, right now, I think it's a tough buy. And you're likely have as trending as this is to the upside, you're as likely to have drawdown as you are profits if you first buy silver here and now.
Rick, again, for that long-term investor, and since you have been in the commodity sector for so long, we do hear from some commentators about a super cycle, or quite frankly, just how long cycles last in commodities. What's your assessment of clearly a bull market cycle, but time frame, duration of this cycle?
Well, look, if we use gold as a proxy for metals, it's been tagging along with the S&P for the last 20, 25 years. I think if you go back to the year 2000, you've done just as well in gold as you have in the spiders. And that's actually pretty darn remarkable if you think about it. So, precious metals, especially gold, has had a phenomenal run. I'd love to see it pull back as much as we, and I wrote this yesterday, clients, as much as we love to see our P&L continuously grow with minimal drawdowns, there are times that you actually want to see a draw, not necessarily a drawdown, but a pullback in where your profits are, whatever that number is, in order to have a chance to buy lower. I mean, think about it in terms of the S&P. Wouldn't you prefer a 5% pullback now to get in rather than trying to chase and buying all-time highs and knowing that at any given time you could fall 5+% simply because for no particular reason other than just how much this market's moved up in just a few months off of that April low? We don't love to see our when we look at our P&L and our brokerage accounts, we like seeing higher numbers consistently. But if you're a willing buyer in a pullback, gee, you kind of want to see that pullback instead of, do I want to buy the S&P up here or do I want to buy the S&P, several hundred points lower? So, to me, that's kind of how you want to think. So if you think long term, then the pullbacks are super opportunities to get long. Pull up a S&P chart for a 100-year chart. There's very few things in life if you're ever going to find that look as good as that for a long-term chart that's investable. It starts on the lower left of your screen and ends on the upper right. Over time you want to be invested in stocks. So pullbacks are opportunities to get in. And sometimes those pullbacks have deeper pullbacks than you'd like to see. But if you're a long-term investor, even those horrific pullbacks that we saw from 2000 to 2003, or October 2007 to March 2009, moves that can knock 50% to 70% off of these indexes, they're ultimately all buying opportunities for the long haul.
Yeah, hard to beat the opportunities in general equities over the long term and over long periods of time. You're always going to benefit by buying those dips. You mentioned looking forward to potentially seeing a pullback in gold for reloading and taking some more positions. I'm curious what you do with something like copper, though, where it's at all-time highs right now. Some of that based on the potential tariffs on copper, but it was already blasting above $5 twice. Once last year, once earlier this year. This is the third time a charm here. And I've noticed that on the copper producers in the ETF COPEX, COPX, they're not getting to the same high levels that they were when copper first breached $5 last year. So maybe just your thoughts on copper itself as a economic bellwether, but also the copper stocks and how they're not really following the metal to the same degree they were.
No, they're not. And if you look at like one of the biggest names like FCX, Freeport Mac, it's a little disappointing to see where it is relative to where it's been. Right now, even with the up move in copper, you still have the chance for it's early yet to make that call, but you're still in the neighborhoods of what the spike high was in early July on the day that Trump announced the what was it, 10%, 25% copper tariff, 50%? I can't even keep track
50,
anymore.
50, he so.
Percent, right, tariff. So that was the first week of July, and we're kind of yesterday and today, those are where the highs are. Now, it's no surprise if it pushes past. The breakout looks real. Unless you're an experienced futures player, I wouldn't be using futures as, the way you play this. But here, I'll tell you, from the 2022 low in copper, which was down at $3.20 or so, the target off of that move is, hold on, I'll get your precise level for the futures. It's 609. So, you're kind of the eighth inning of that rally to what the target is. And it doesn't mean it can't go higher. And the breakout looks real, so you want to be buying pullbacks. Looking at copper as a indicative type market for the health of the economy, that's all good. So it all spells to buy pullbacks. Buy a little now if you have zero exposure, but save 75% of the money that you are going to invest for pullbacks. And in commodities, yeah, they generally come. They generally come.
Rick, let's look at gold stocks too, because as much as people were saying maybe last year, especially early on last year, how gold stocks were lagging the strong gold price, now that gold has moved sideways in a way, maybe consolidated over the last 3+ months, gold stocks have continued to do pretty well. And we've even noticed a lot of money filtering down into the smaller stocks. Almost seems like an even more bullish or risk-on environment for the gold stocks. Take us through what you see. Either gold stocks broadly, as in GDX or GDXJ, or any leadership you've seen in any in particular names.
Well, all right. So GDX is what I use as my benchmark for the whole sector. It's made the highest highs this month and last month for the move. You're back to virtually the highest high made in 2012. The all-time high is in 2011. And that's just about 60, what is that, $67 or so in GDX. It's currently at 53 and change. So it still has room to go to challenge those all-time highs. But I think more importantly is, and I was just writing about this as part of my weekly report that goes across lots of sectors. If you get a pullback to the mid-40s, let's call it, a 10% pullback, may not get it, but that's kind of where the good support is now. And that's where the high from 2020 was that we just took out also. So I think if you get a chance and you get to buy GDX in the upper 40s, you do it. I think down the road you'll be rewarded. And I do think it's going to take time, but I do think ultimately there's a very decent chance that GDX makes a new all-time high and takes out that 2011 high. A lot of stuff has to happen for that to occur. But looking at how this, is formulated and where it broke down from, first you got to get through kind of right above where we are now at 56-ish. And then if you can build a base above 56, you test 63 and a half to 67. And then if you get above there, you get new all-time highs and, it's a whole nother leg.
Just a quick follow-up on that, Rick, because you've been following the sector for so long. It's surprising to me, and I think a lot of other people, that we're not already at all-time highs in the GDX, considering that high from 2011. I remember that vividly. That was when gold went all the way up to 1923. Now we're at 3,300, 3,400, and the margins back then, I think, were 650 an ounce for the average producer. Now the margins are $1,200, $1,500 for producers. So the fattest margins ever. And the biggest percentage of margins and revenues ever, the highest gold price ever, and we haven't even made a new high. what do you make of that as far as following these indexes versus the underlying commodities and the discrepancy there?
If I had to guess what it is, because I don't know, but if I had to guess what it is, it's that for so long the sector has been a underperformer that it just doesn't have the interest that other ones did. If you're a portfolio manager, and let's say you're a global macro portfolio manager and you can put your money wherever you want to, you would have done much better being in technology stocks than thinking about gold stocks for the last 15 years. It's just not a sector that's done anything appreciable. I'm not saying it hasn't, doubled or tripled in price, but if you compare that to, think back to, let me think what year it was. I think it was 2009, the Great Financial Crisis. The S&P bottomed at 666. Look at where it is now. I mean, it's 10 times the price. So it's just that the sector is unloved by the street, which probably means there's opportunity here down the road. And it's probably a sector to be involved in because if it starts moving higher, it has a chance to really pick up some steam. But I think that's probably why it's just not even near, on percentage basis, it still has such a decent amount to go to hit that all-time high at 67.
Okay. Well, targets to watch for, and maybe we do see that shift and outperformance. It takes a little time for people to warm back up to sectors. What about old school energy? Oil, natural gas. Oil continues to be stuck in a lower trading range now after recently breaking down. Natural gas has been coming off a little bit. What's your outlook for either of these sectors?
So there are two major parts of the market that we look at when you look across the asset classes. There are two major places that I continuously tell both institutional investors and retail clients to stay away from, and that is oil and the US bond market. The 10-year has a pretty flat 50-week moving average. People in the industry are more confused than ever. Bond portfolio managers, you're not getting the clue out of the bond market as to the clues you normally get to help other markets, which include the US equity market, the US dollar, and to some extent, commodities. So the bond market, I kind of want nothing to do with, and the crude oil market, I want nothing to do with. I think it was a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago at most. I looked at the CFTC Commitment of Traders report. 85% of all open contracts were held by what's considered smart money, producers, processors, people in the industry. The speculators have pretty much walked away from oil as they should. It has done nothing appreciable in a few years. And so, what was it back in 2022 when the Ukraine war, against Russia started and oil spiked to what, $130 a barrel? It sold down from there to 65-ish and then went to 95 and then back. And now that, this year we made new lower lows. Percentage wise, there's stuff there. But day in, day out, if you think you're going to outsmart the oil market, and you're not in the oil market, I'm gonna tell you, chances are you're gonna get your rear end handed to you trying to trade oil. And when 85% of all open interest is by people in the industry, you don't want to play that market. You have absolutely no edge. So I'm just telling people there's nothing to do at $65 oil. And there's nothing to do with $75 oil, and there's nothing to do with $55 oil. And that's the range this year. So there's nothing to do in oil. Now, gas, different story. It's been selling off recently, broke the uptrend line from the low. So that's just a little bit more interesting in the sense of will it or can it make new lows? For people who are long the ETF like UNG, it's a horrible, horrible long-term investment. And the energy space in general has been, if you look at XLE divided by, let's say, the spiders, I think even as of last week, it just made a new secular low. So it peaked in October of 22, I think it was. And it's pretty much been steadily declining versus the S&P since then. So it's just a, and if you look back 20 years or 25 years to when these spider sector ETFs started trading in the year 2000, there's no sector other than energy that in the last 25 years you've actually not made a penny in being in. I mean, think about it. You've not made a penny in energy. So it's just not a sector that really interests me. And personally, I own Chevron, and I think that may be the only name I own in the entire space.
Well, Rick, on the energy tip, but maybe a different commodity, what are your thoughts on uranium, which has had a lot of attention this year from the Trump executive orders? He did four executive orders on nuclear. When you look at an ETF like URA, it's not at all-time highs because that happened back in 2011 as well, pre-Fukushima, but it's at 52-week highs, and it's definitely on a good uptrend the last few years. How do you look at something like uranium and the uranium equities?
So it's had a huge move since the April low. That ETF was trading $20 on the April low, and now it's 42. And so it's more than a double. The target from the 2022 low, which was the secular low for the stock market, is not even a dollar higher from where it's trading. So do I want to buy it here and now? No. Do I think it gets back under 33, where it broke out from? Probably not. But if I have a choice of buying something at 42, I mean, right now, where would I put first support? About $37. That's the earliest I would consider buying.
Interesting. Rick, let's also move over to the crypto space because cryptos have done pretty well as well. A lot of, I guess, regulatory support or the government sure talking a lot about crypto and crypto stock being added to the S&P, more crypto IPOs coming out. There's a lot going on in the crypto space. What has your eye? What are any targets you have for Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin had a target at 118 and change. The next target is 122.5, and above that 125, let's call it 126, and above there 131 or so. This is for Bitcoin futures. And so that, and I use that as the proxy. The thing is with something like Bitcoin, you know you could buy it and have a 30% drawdown. It's just the nature of the beast in this particular market. But it had a double top near 110,000 that lasted for 6 months before it broke out a couple months ago. So I'd say anywhere from 110 to probably, I don't know, 105 or so now should be support. And I was asking a friend of mine who has been so correct about crypto. It took me a long time to, get involved myself. And it's still been as a percent of my total assets, it's a small piece. As a percent of his assets, it's a very large piece. So I asked him a few questions this week. One is, I said, by chance, what's your average price in Bitcoin? And he says it's about $8,000. So he's made a killing because he was an early adapter. I asked him, if you were going to put money in crypto now, where would you put it? Because there's talk that, Ripple could have this and Ethereum's playing catch up. The He said, it's a no-brainer. I'm thinking, well, I don't have a brain. I don't know which one. And his answer was Bitcoin because of the limited supply. And as high as this thing is priced, he claims, and he's clearly, a Kool-Aid drinker of it, but he's also been completely right. He thinks, in the scheme of things, it's still is only in the first inning of where it's going. Now, that to me is pretty hard to fathom, given that, you could have bought this at $20,000. I think when futures started trading a few years back, it was at $18,000, right? So it's already six times that price in a few years. He thinks, you can play some other coins, but he still thinks Bitcoin has a huge move coming. because there's only so much Bitcoin that can forever be, what do they call it, mined. And therefore, the value of it has to go up over time, as long as there's increased demand. And based on everything we know, and the more, including the government, getting involved in other places in the world doing so, he thinks, that's where you put your money. And you live with some of the crazy moves along the way, but you have to be committed to it, and you have to be willing to have, multi-double digit percentage moves potentially against you in order for the bigger picture. So it's clearly a very speculative idea. But think back to a year or two ago when Jamie Dimon would say, it's a joke, we're not doing it, da 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 da. And now, JP Morgan's all over it. The more and more it gets accepted, the more demand it creates for an instrument that has limited supply.
Crazy to think it could be early innings because boy, oh boy, what a run it's been on. But hey, the ETFs are new and the adopters, the big institutions, they are starting to adopt it even more. And I guess globally, it's still kind of a small market, but just crazy to think about that. But hey, either way, Rick, great chatting with you. Thank you very much for sharing your insights on, again, a wide range of markets. And for everyone that wants to follow along with Rick, for all you active traders out there, and even traders that want to take longer term positions, visit the In the Know Trader website. Visit our website within your podcast player or our YouTube channel for that direct link. Rick, very much enjoy our conversation. Thank you so much for taking time to share your thoughts. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.